From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Alan Dershowitz. With clients like Klaus von Bülow, Mike Tyson, Leona Helmsley, and Jim Baker, he's become one of America's most controversial lawyers. He's also one of the most outspoken when it comes to civil liberties. Also today, writer Doris Lessing remembers the country of her childhood. She was exiled from Zimbabwe for 25 years because of her opposition to the white minority government. She has a new book about what it was like to finally go back home. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Art of Ike Quebec, a new reissue from the soulful late tenor saxophonist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Governor Bill Clinton took his campaign to the western states today, working for support in a part of the country that's voted almost solidly for Republican presidential candidates in the past. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton appeared at a rally in Pueblo, Colorado, flanked by seven Democratic western governors. This is a part of the country where voters have been electing Democrats to run the states and Republicans to run their country. But Clinton is out to change that formula. Of the three western states he'll visit today, polls show Colorado leaning to Clinton, Montana a toss-up. Only Wyoming looks as though it will stay in the Republican column. Clinton doesn't need these western states to win. Together, Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado have only 14 electoral votes. But his visits could boost turnout, helping Democrats running for the Senate. Here in Pueblo, Clinton praised Democratic candidate Ben Nighthorse Campbell. Tomorrow in Washington State, he'll offer his coattails to Patty Murray, running for the Senate seat formerly held by Democrat Brock Adams. In Pueblo, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush campaigned today in North Carolina, continuing his whistle-stop train ride through the South in territory that's usually considered to be solidly Republican. As he did in the last debate, the president continued his attacks on Bill Clinton's character and leadership. He accused Clinton of waffling on his support for the Persian Gulf War and tried to establish what he says is a pattern of deception on Clinton's part. Both sides are reported to be watching the latest polling information to see whether the president gained from his aggressive approach in the Monday debate. Arab and Israeli negotiators have started a seventh round of peace talks at the State Department. This marks a year since the talks opened at a conference in Madrid. Barry Schwide reports.
The talks will go on until November 19th, past the presidential elections, and will be held with an eye on those elections. Each move the negotiators consider will call for doublethink. How would it be received by a second Bush administration, and how by a Clinton administration? Having brought the two sides together, the State Department is trying to keep them working. Israel and Syria, in the last round, began to consider a territory for peace trade-off. And Israelis and Palestinians were looking at self-rule arrangements for Palestinians on the West Bank and in Gaza. Now the question is whether they will pick up the pace or just go through the motions, watching for the November 3rd results. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
The insurance industry said today that new estimates of the damage from Hurricane Andrew make it the world's costliest natural disaster. The American Insurance Services Group raised its estimate of the damage from $7.8 billion to $10.7 billion. The previous record was held by the winter storm that hit Britain in 1990, causing $8.5 billion worth of damage. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over 1 point to close at 3,186. This is NPR. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has endorsed an agreement resuming humanitarian aid to Iraq. United Nations relief operations in Iraq have been largely on hold since the 1st of July when the previous relief agreement expired. The government of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has resisted renewing the aid program, which directs a large part of its effort to dissident regions such as the Kurdish area in the north. The new agreement calls for a $200 million aid package, about half of which is to be sent to the Kurdish region. The U.S. opposed the agreement, saying it could restrict the movement of aid workers. The countdown continues at the Kennedy Space Center as NASA prepares to launch its seventh shuttle mission of the year. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Preparations for tomorrow's launch of the Space Shuttle Columbia are proceeding along without any problems. The shuttle is undergoing the final checkout before being cleared for fueling. The only concern at this time that may prevent an on-time liftoff would be high winds at Kennedy Space Center's emergency landing strip. Forecasters, nevertheless, say there's a 70% chance that conditions will be favorable. Meanwhile, the mission's mid-deck experiments have been loaded and are ready for launch. The six-member crew has been briefed on their flight plan and on the condition of their primary payload. The shuttle will carry the Italian Lagios 2 satellite into orbit, allowing scientists on the ground to more precisely track the shift of Earth's continents. That could lead to a more accurate prediction of natural disasters, such as earthquakes. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Former FBI Director William Webster released a report today on the government investigation into the Los Angeles riots, warning that they could happen again. The report strongly criticized former police chief Daryl Gates, saying that he failed to properly prepare his force for the violence that began on April 29th. Gates denounced the study's authors as liars. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Dershowitz may think of his clients as underdogs, but the public doesn't necessarily agree. Many of his clients are rich and famous and privileged. He's represented Leona Helmsley, Michael Milken, Jim Baker, Mike Tyson, and Klaus von Bülow. The movie Reversal of Fortune was based on Dershowitz's book about the von Bülow case. Dershowitz is now consulting with Mia Farrow on her case against Woody Allen. Even before Dershowitz became famous for representing famous people, he was famous for taking on unpopular causes which represent larger civil liberties issues. For instance, he supported the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. Dershowitz specializes in civil liberties cases. He's also a law professor at Harvard. His new book, Contrary to Popular Opinion, is a collection of his recent newspaper columns. In the introduction, he writes, "I am difficult to chart on the conventional left, right, liberal, conservative continua."
Well, I'm not a conventional leftist. Obviously, I come from a left tradition. I'm a civil libertarian. I'm easy to place on that spectrum. I'm a strident civil libertarian, maybe even an extremist civil libertarian. I believe in absolute free speech. Well, actually, I call myself a relative absolutist on free speech because I can theoretically imagine a case for censorship, but I've never seen one. I've never seen a compelling case for censorship. I try very hard, this probably will sound a little audacious, but I try very hard to think through every issue from first principles. I don't belong to any clubs. I'm not a groupthink person, and I'm not politically correct.
What are your criteria for taking on a controversial case with a defendant who is a celebrity or very much in the public eye?
Well, first of all, I have the same criteria for taking on a case involving a celebrity or a non-celebrity. The vast majority of my cases involve obscure people, people on death row, people with no money. Recently, a woman whose children were taken away from her on charges of sexual abuse, in which we were able to prove that she did not, but somebody else sexually abused the children. Those are my typical cases. My criteria is the same. I have to feel that there was a terrible injustice done to the defendant. I don't have to think that the defendant is innocent. I don't have to think that the defendant is nice, but I have to feel that there was an injustice. I also have to feel this is a case that I can use in my classroom teaching, and it's a case that I can bring my classroom experience into the courtroom. It has to be something that fits me like a glove. And I turned down a great many fascinating cases involving very famous celebrities because they don't fit. I get 100 cases offered to me for every one that I take, and so I have an ability to select, pick my cases. So those are essentially the criteria. I take 50% of my cases on a pro bono basis. That's been a rule that I've had in my office since the time I started to practice. And beyond that, I will turn down no case ever because of the unpopularity of the defendant or what the defendant is accused of doing.
Do you ever worry that having become something of a celebrity lawyer and have, you know, taking on clients like Jim Baker and Klaus von Bülow, that people have become cynical about you as a publicity hound?
Oh, sure. There's no question about that. That's the risk you take. On the other hand, those are great cases. Klaus von Bülow, the ability to turn around public opinion in this country, everybody was sure he was guilty and would be convicted, and we were able to demonstrate that if you give somebody a new trial and bring in all the evidence, a jury will find that person not guilty. It was one of the few publicly known cases where a constitutional right turned a case around from a guilty verdict to an innocent verdict, and I think it really undercut in the mind of many people the notion that these are mere legal technicalities.
What about Leona Helmsley, Jim Baker? What were your reasons for taking them on?
Well, Jim Baker, let's take him first. He got a 45-year sentence, and we got that sentence reversed on the basis of a holding by the United States Court of Appeals that the judge had engaged in religious bigotry by enhancing his sentence because the judge disagreed with the religious beliefs of Jim Baker. And if you can do it to Jim Baker, who is obviously not very well-liked, not my kind of person, you can do it for anybody. And that was a very important civil liberties issue involved in that case. Leona Helmsley, I really believe, was a victim of a combination between the media and the prosecutor's office. They both played off each other. They try to portray her as the Queen of Mean, as somebody whose description rhymes with witch. By the way, I thought there was a lot of sexism involved in that case. When a man is tough and aggressive in business, they don't use that B word to describe him. Indeed, they have only complimentary words to describe him. And yet Leona Helmsley was always described very negatively, and I believe there was a selective prosecution. She would not have gotten 4 years in prison if she had not been the Queen of Mean and somebody who was so loathed by members of the community. And I thought there was a very important issue in that case. There was also a very important double jeopardy issue in that case, and we won that. We got all the state charges against her dismissed on grounds of double jeopardy. By the way, that clearly relates to some of the most compelling cases today, the Rodney King case, where I believe the police should not be tried again, even though I think there was a terrible miscarriage of justice. That, again, shows you, I think, my position, hard to chart. Most liberals would say that there was a miscarriage of justice in the Rodney King verdict, and therefore the police should be tried again. I don't buy the therefore. There was a miscarriage of justice, but there is a double jeopardy clause, and that interferes with trying him again, and we won that in Leona Helmsley's case, and it was a very important victory.
Isn't the trial of the police officers in the Rodney King case the Justice Department?
Of course it is, and that's the same, to me, why it's so compelling. The United States Supreme Court has erroneously ruled that if another sovereign tries somebody for the identical conduct, that somehow circumvents the Bill of Rights. By the way, the ACLU changed its policy to allow it to support that second prosecution. They had always previously had a policy of opposing a second prosecution by a different sovereign. And if you think of the implications of that for civil liberties, they're quite scary. What will happen in the second Rodney King case? The same exact piece of evidence, the same videotape, will be shown to different jurors, and they'll be asked to come to a different verdict on the same evidence. It is double jeopardy, pure and simple.
What are some of the obstacles to handling a case where parties are celebrities, where the case becomes a public case, you know, where people are reading about it in the newspaper and in magazines, where mobs of spectators and press show up whenever there's a hearing?
I've handled cases involving celebrities that you've never heard of and you'll never hear of. I'll go to my grave with those secrets because we've managed to keep them out of the glare of publicity. And when we want to keep something out of the public eye, we are pretty successful at doing it, provided that both parties agreed.
Do you think that celebrities want to be represented by somebody in the celebrity class?
I think they make a mistake when they pick their lawyer on that basis. And I've turned down a number of celebrities who wanted me because they thought I would add some kind of celebrity or glamour to their case. That's not the criteria to take a case. I'll give you one example of a case I turned down. Mostly I can't tell you about cases I turned down because that's confidential. But Pamela Smart announced that I had turned down her case, so I'm free to discuss it. She's the woman who was accused of hiring her or getting her boyfriend to kill her husband in New Hampshire. And the issue in that case on appeal was going to be whether there was unfair pretrial publicity. And I was very frank with her, and I said, look, don't hire Alan Dershowitz to bring a case challenging publicity. It just isn't a good mix, because I'm generally in the case to try to level the playing field, to try to bring positive publicity to my client after my client has been savaged by negative publicity. Get a good, nice, quiet, discreet, dignified lawyer to handle your appeal in this case. He or she will be able to bring more credibility to the issue of pretrial publicity than I could. So I turn down a lot of cases because I'm not the right person. I never take a case where a client asks me to play up to the lawyer, to the judge, to ask for a favor, to do anything behind the scenes, to be part of the old boy, the old girl network. That's not me. I recommend lawyers who can do that. I take cases where the kind of talents that I hope I have work to the benefit of the client. And if I ever take the wrong case, that's the worst thing a lawyer can do, is take a case that that lawyer is not suited for. And I've seen so many disasters when lawyers take on cases where they're good lawyers, but this is not the right case for them.
My guest is Alan Dershowitz, and he's written a new book called Contrary to Popular Opinion. It's a collection of his recent essays. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Lawyer Alan Dershowitz is my guest, and he has a new book called Contrary to Popular Opinion. I want to get back to the subject of political correctness. Mm-hmm. You say that on the left, when people talk about diversity, really diversity is being used as a code word for something that's not about diversity
absolutely,
at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. Nobody I know on the left who claims to want diversity would enthusiastically vote for an evangelical Christian fundamentalist to join the Harvard Law School faculty. Now that would give us real diversity. Nobody I know would vote enthusiastically for a active member of the National Rifle Association or a strong supporter of the right to life or some other people, a Hasidic Jew, a fundamentalist Hasidic Jew. What they want are people who fit their political profile. They want more of them. They want to replicate themselves. That is the exact opposite of diversity. What they want is political power, and they want to use the concept of diversity to achieve political power. The last thing they want is true diversity, people who would bring new intellectual perspectives and approaches to a place like Harvard Law School. And but I've told that's true in other universities as well.
What's your posture on the issue of diversity in the law school?
I support diversity. I would love to see really more diverse views, but diversity means blacks who think like blacks and blacks who think like whites and women who think like women and women who think like men. And the one thing I don't want and can't tolerate is a system where we discriminate against women and blacks, who we've discriminated against for years, by requiring of them and not of white males that they pass a litmus test. We don't require white males to pass a litmus test of whether they not only are white males, but they have to think like white males, but we require blacks and women under this political correctness doctrine to pass a political litmus test, that they not only provide racial diversity, but that they also agree with the political perspective of those who are pushing their appointments.
Don't you think that that kind of, you know, quote, politically correct litmus test is sometimes in reaction to a previous litmus test that's been issued by, say, an administration who's looking for a certain, a black faculty member or a black judge or something, because there's that suspicion that they've found, like, the one out of 1,000
sure.
Black people whose thoughts would really coincide with the white establishment that's hiring them.
I can understand that when it comes to, say, an appointment of a Clarence Thomas. You've described exactly why President Bush appointed Clarence Thomas. He searched through that haystack and found the one needle of a stealth candidate who clearly, although black racially, was against affirmative action, was against a whole range of issues that are important to the black community. That hasn't happened at Harvard Law School. Nobody has gone out to look for African Americans who think like whites or women who think like Phyllis Schlafly. In fact, we don't have any on the faculty, so I don't believe that it is a reaction to that. I think it's a power grab, and it's a power grab in the name of diversity, and that's why I'm opposed to it.
Okay, something else you've said about political correctness, that there's a double standard, that women and blacks are entirely free to attack white men, radical
right.
feminists can accuse
right.
all men of being rapists, but radical African-Americans, and radical African-Americans can accuse all whites of being racists, but whites can't parody blacks. Whites can't say bad things about blacks. Men can't say bad things about women.
Absolutely correct, and it's understandable. It's affirmative action in the area of speech. Basically, what it says is, look, men have been sexists for so long and whites have been racists for so long that it's okay for women to be a little sexist and for African Americans to be a little racist. In response, we have to really be a little tolerant. It's paternalistic. And I refuse to be paternalistic to my African-American friends, to my women friends, I'm going to treat them absolutely equally. And whatever the rule is for white males in terms of free speech, and it should be totally broad and totally permissive, the same rule should apply to women, to African-Americans. And I believe that at a university, anything goes in terms of speech. You know, people tell me, should a university, they ask, be governed by the same principles of the First Amendment as the public forum is? And I say, no, the principle should be even greater. There should be even more freedom of speech at universities than in public squares. What better place than a university to allow people to explore every aspect of their ideas, not to be constrained in any way by censorship or language control? And if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. A university is a place to explore ideas, not to accept conventional constraints. And, you know, the young men and women, students particularly, who insist on being treated as adults when it comes to the sexuality, when it comes to drinking, suddenly when it comes to politics and free speech, they run to Big Daddy and Big Mommy, the dean and the president, and they say, please, 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 we're children, protect us from free speech. Create a shelter for us. We can't stand the idea that there's a Confederate flag flying at Harvard. It doesn't allow me to study and work, a black woman said last year, to know that a Confederate flag is flying on the dormitory of one particular student at Harvard. Grow up. You're in a university. If you lived in South Carolina, the Confederate flag would be flying from the state house. Oppose it when it comes to a state legislature, but you're in a major university. You can't be so thin-skinned as to expect that everything is going to go your way. Life's not that easy, and a university is a training ground for real diversity. And, you know, when I teach students at Harvard, I keep telling them, you're not in the real world. I ask students in my class, how many of you favor the death penalty? And maybe 10% raise their hand. How many of you oppose it? 90% raise your hand. Then I tell them, in the real world, 86% of Americans favor the death penalty, and only 10 or 12% oppose it. If you're going to be a real lawyer out there, you're going to have to deal with juries that are not replicated in the classes at Harvard Law School. And so you darn well better hear views that are offensive to you, that you don't like, because those are the views that many Americans hold out there. And if you want to be a good lawyer, you have to know how to oppose those, not by censorship, but by more speech.
Why did you first decide to go into law school?
I don't think I had a choice. When I was a kid, everybody told me I had a good mouth, but not a very good head. In fact, my high school yearbook described me as having a mouth of Webster and a head of clay, and they didn't mean Henry. And my rabbi in yeshiva, where I went to high school, said to me, you should do something where you have to use your mouth and not your brain. You should either become a conservative rabbi. I went to an Orthodox school, so that was the biggest put down the rabbi could come up with, or I should become a lawyer. And I didn't want to be a rabbi, so I had to be a lawyer. I had no choice. I was always a verbal street fighter. And I'm one of these lawyers who never, ever wanted to be a judge. I couldn't abide the notion of being a judge, even a justice of the Supreme Court. The idea of shifting from being an athlete to an umpire just has no appeal to me at all. I was born an advocate. I love advocacy, and I love what I'm doing.
You know, you were in the top of your class in Harvard Law School.
Yale.
Were you a very competitive student?
I was a very competitive student. I'm a very competitive person. I'm totally non-competitive at home with my family and with my friends. But in my professional life, I'm competitive. I'm aggressive. I'm confrontational. The book is an in-your-face book. I mean, it's a direct challenge to justices of the Supreme Court, to lawyers. That's what I enjoy doing.
Do people ever find it obnoxious when you're that in your face?
People always find it obnoxious. I mean, I'm a designated obnoxious professor. I mean, that's part of my job. I like provoking. I don't make people happy. You know, I used to get a lot of letters from colleges and universities asking me to become a dean or a president, and I used to send them my Groucho Marx letter saying I would never want to be associated with any school that would have the poor judgment to want me to be the dean or the president of the university. I don't bring people together. I don't make nice. I don't soothe and massage people. I confront them. That's my job as a teacher.
In 1963 to 64, you clerked with Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, and I think that was his first year on the court?
No, his second year. I was picked by him during his first year, but I actually served in his middle year. He was only on the court for 3 years, and it was a wonderful experience.
Can you give me a sense of what you learned from him?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing I learned mostly was how to be a compassionate lawyer. He would always, and the judge I clerked for before him, Judge David Bazelon, would always talk about not only the writ of habeas corpus, but the writ of Rachmanis. What Rachmanis is a Hebrew Yiddish phrase for compassion. And these were activist judges who saw their mandate as doing justice. And there was always a technical way to do justice if you had the will to do it. Cutting through legal technicalities, being the master of the legal system rather than just an agent of the legal system was their constant message. And remember, Arthur Goldberg was a great, great lawyer before he was ever nominated to the Supreme Court. There is not a single justice in the Supreme Court today who was a great practicing lawyer before they got on the Supreme Court. We have a Supreme Court of relative mediocrities. We had a great law professor, Antonin Scalia. But beyond that, if you just look at the other eight justices, none of them had really reached a level of the kind of distinction that other countries demand when they put people in their high courts, other Western democracies, whether it be Canada or New Zealand or England or Israel or France. We have a very mediocre Supreme Court by the levels of other Western democracies, and it's a tragedy.
If you think our Supreme Court is mediocre, has that done anything to change your faith in America's judicial system?
Oh, I have faith in America's judicial system largely, as I write in my book, because it includes the jury. If we only had judges, I'd have very, very little faith in our legal system. When you have a president of the United States who's willing to get on national television with a straight face and say that Clarence Thomas is the most qualified American in the United States to serve on the Supreme Court, that doesn't even pass the giggle test. I mean, George, you know, watch my lips, read my lips. That's just not true. You can't persuade anybody of that.
Have you ever been really disappointed by a jury?
Oh, yeah, of course. Rodney King was a very disappointing jury verdict. The acquittal of the murderer of Rabbi Meir Kahana here in New York City. Juries make mistakes all the time, but I think generally they make honest mistakes. The difference between juries and judges is judges sit on thousands of cases. They get cynical. They just want to get the case going. For a jury, it's their only shot at doing justice. Very few people have ever served on more than one jury. And I think they try very, very hard. And you can't whisper to a jury. Whatever you say to a jury is a matter of public record. And I suspect that many people whisper to many judges. There is a great deal of corruption in the American judiciary. It's not cash corruption, but the old boy and the old girl system operates and is alive and well in the United States of America today. People call judges. Judges owe people favors. Judges want to get promoted. And so they want to ingratiate themselves with lawyers who have power. Lawyers can get great favors from judges. We still have not eliminated the problem of corruption. We've eliminated the problem of cash payments for the most part, but not of power exchanges, which is just as corrupting an influence.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alan Dershowitz is the author of the new book, Contrary to Popular Opinion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Doris Lessing writes, "You cannot be forbidden the land you grew up in." So says the web of sensations, memories, and experience that binds you to that landscape. Coming up, Lessing remembers Zimbabwe, where she grew up. Back then it was Rhodesia. She was banned from returning for 25 years. She's written a new book about her first trips back. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of recordings by the late soulful saxophonist Ike Quebec. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has been on a two-day campaign trip to the South, where today in North Carolina he told supporters that he was going to do what Harry Truman did back in 1948 and show pollsters they don't know what they are talking about. Bush campaign advisors concede that he's behind in Georgia and North Carolina, but slightly ahead in South Carolina. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton has been campaigning in the West as he tries to get support from voters who in past elections have generally supported Republican candidates. He told a rally in Colorado that he is campaigning there to reinforce the idea that he is a different kind of Democrat. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has indicated that he will endorse a $220 million aid package for Iraq despite UN objections. This question has led to something of a split between Washington and its allies. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In a letter to the Security Council, Boutros-Ghali acknowledged that the aid agreement does not fully meet the UN's aspirations, but he said with winter coming on, it is imperative that a relief program begin in Iraq as soon as possible. Under the agreement, the UN is to station 300 guards, mostly in the Kurdish-controlled areas of the north, to protect relief workers. U.S. officials have complained that the agreement gives Baghdad too much control over where and when UN personnel may travel and over what kind of radio communication system they use. But the U.S. position has apparently won little support among the other Security Council members. By pressing ahead with the plan, Boutros-Ghali risks a confrontation with Washington, although he technically does not need U.S. approval to enact it. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Israel has started handing out new gas masks to all Israeli citizens, but Palestinians in the occupied territories will not receive them. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
As the seventh round of U.S.-sponsored Arab-Israeli peace talks began today, some Israelis had a very different subject on their minds. A two-day test project for the redistribution of gas masks began today to replace masks used during the Gulf War. A report by the state attorney general had found that many of the gas masks used were defective and that the protective tents for infants could even have been dangerous. But a senior official in the Home Front Command said the redistribution was only to improve the fit and comfort of the gas masks and not because they were defective. The gas masks are meant to protect against chemical weapons. During the Gulf War, Iraq fired dozens of Scud missiles at Israel, but none of them had chemical warheads. The Israeli spokesman said Palestinians would not receive gas masks now, but they would be distributed in the territories if there is an emergency. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than a point in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The State Department has called on all factions in the former Yugoslavia to stop fighting. According to a State Department spokesman, both air and ground shipments of aid have been halted by the new fighting. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the U.S. believes that Croatian and Muslim forces have to bear responsibility for increased hardship for people living in Sarajevo. At the same time, officials said that Serbian factions also bear an overwhelming burden of responsibility for continued violence in Bosnia. In Moscow, the Russian parliament has turned down an appeal by President Boris Yeltsin to postpone the next session of the Congress of People's Deputies. Yeltsin has been trying to avoid having parliament interfere with his economic reforms. Tim Huell of the BBC reports.
The Foreign Minister, Andrei Kozyrev, and two other senior officials warned Parliament that opponents of reform, including many deputies, were mounting an ever more serious challenge to Mr. Yeltsin's reform programme. The officials had been summoned to appear by the Parliamentary Speaker, Ruslan Khasbulatov, who demanded an explanation for their earlier remarks to journalists, suggesting he was behind attempts to get rid of the government. Mr. Khasbulatov continually protests his loyalty to Mr. Yeltsin, but Parliament has now dealt a major blow to the President by turning down his request to delay the Congress of People's Deputies until March or April. The Conservative-dominated body will now meet as planned at the beginning of December and will almost certainly refuse to extend Mr. Yeltsin's present powers to issue decrees bypassing Parliament. Liberal deputies fear the Congress will also try to force the government's resignation.
Tim Huell reporting from Moscow. A British tourist was killed and two others wounded today when gunmen opened fire on a bus in southern Egypt. The ambush occurred about 170 miles south of Cairo. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Doris Lessing has a special place in the hearts of many women who came of age in the 60s and 70s. Lessing's novels, like The Golden Notebook and the Martha Quest series, had what many women then were starving for but rarely found, stories about contemporary, independent, unconventional women. Lessing later turned to science fiction. She's lived in England since 1949, but like her character Martha Quest, she grew up in Africa. She was born in Persia and moved to southern Rhodesia when she was five. She later opposed the white minority government, and when she left, she was banned from returning for 25 years. When Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, she was able to go back. Her new memoir, African Laughter, is about the four trips to Zimbabwe she made in the 80s and 90s. These trips led her to think about the past. When she was born, her father worked for a bank in Persia. She told me why her family moved to Africa to start a farm.
My father's family were all farmers. Before him, they were all farmers. They were farmed in Norfolk, Essex, and Suffolk. And his father, for some mysterious reason, I don't know why, became a bank clerk and spent all his time playing the village, the organ in the village church. My father spent his childhood with the farmer's sons. So when he got a chance to farm, he took it. That's one reason. The other reason is that, like many of the soldiers of that old war, that's the First World War, they couldn't stand England anymore. They regarded themselves as having been betrayed because, I mean, people would laugh now at their innocence, but those soldiers believed that this was a war to end war. And they were very idealistic in a way that nobody was in the Second World War or could be now. So even now you can meet people, old men from Germany, France, very old men who will tell you the same. They believe that they fought the war in the trenches to end war. Well, my father just thought that England was corrupt and had broken all its promises and didn't want to live there again. So he went out to southern Rhodesia.
Did he get what he wanted?
He didn't get what he said he wanted. What he wanted to be... He was all set to be a successful farmer and grow maize and become rich and all that. But what he actually did was to spend his life in the bush, I think rather happily, watching nature at it, you know, and watching stars and the ants and the bushfires. I think he was rather happy.
Your father employed 40 to 60 Africans on the farm, depending on the season. What was your relationship with the workers?
Well, it was the relationship of a white minority with a very suppressed black population. You know, I was like all the whites, we were behaved as if we owned the place, which we did for a bit.
In one of your short stories, you wrote about a girl growing up on a farm in Africa. And she says the black people on the farm were as remote as the trees and the rocks. It was impossible to think of the black people who worked about the house as friends, for if she talked to one of them, her mother would come running anxiously, "Come away, you mustn't talk to natives."
That's right. That was true in southern Rhodesia. It was not true in South Africa, interestingly enough, because you meet South Africans brought up. They will always talk about their black nanny, you know, with immense affection. But this didn't happen in southern Rhodesia. There was a... I think it's probably because the physical conquest of the place, which is a very brutal one, was quite recent. It was only in the 1890s.
When did you become uncomfortable with that relationship?
Oh, much later. You know, people that like to romanticize this a bit, you know, they say, oh, how were you able to see the truth when other people did not? Well, I did not see the truth. Being uncomfortable about what you see, which I certainly was, is one thing, but knowing what was wrong, you have to have something to compare it with, and I had nothing to compare it with. I didn't have anything. No one I ever met had a different perspective. So it wasn't until I had grown up a bit and I met other people that I was able to see the system for what it was. That's when I became an antagonist of the system.
And what did you do to show your...
There were a group of people who were, most of them, communists, or called themselves communists, which was very common in those days, you know, because looking back, of course, they weren't communists at all. And we ran an inordinate number of societies. Most of them were informational, like left clubs and study groups, and you name it, we ran it. And in fact, we did have quite a useful effect while it lasted, not least on ourselves, because, you know, if you're providing everybody else in sight with books and libraries and pamphlets, you learn quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. What was your awakening to women's status in society? And I ask you that because so many women think of your novel, A Golden Notebook, as being the first feminist novel they ever read.
I know they do, but I never wrote it as a feminist novel.
I know you've said that.
See, what I was writing was simply out of my own experience, which I think has got a valuable lesson. I do not think writers ought ever to sit down and think they must write about some cause or theme or something.
Mm-hmm.
If they write about their own experiences, something is true is going to emerge, whether they mean it or not. About the status of women, my mother, in her time, was a feminist. You know, she fought her father to go off and be a nurse. Now, this is by no means a simple fight, because he was in advance of his time and he wanted her to go to university. You know, it wasn't very common for girls to go to university. She said, no, I'm going off to be a nurse. And he said, like a bad novel, if you do, never darken my doors again. And she went off, became a nurse, was extremely good at it and successful. And then he wanted to forgive her, and she didn't forgive him. This is a very sad story, in fact. I'm not saying she never spoke to him, but she didn't forgive him because she had such a hard time doing it on her own. And she had all kinds of feminist ideas, which for her time were quite advanced, so I was brought up with them.
My guest is Doris Lessing. She's written a new memoir called African Laughter. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Doris Lessing is my guest. You spent several years in a convent school, 5 years, I believe, and you write that it harmed you and that you're still learning how much harm. What was the damage that it did to you?
Well, it was first I was homesick to the extent of being physically ill and certainly emotionally ill. I was desperately, desperately miserable, and I think a lot of children are, in boarding schools. And sometimes they forget it and sometimes they don't. They were also, most of the women who ran the place were German peasant women who were tragic figures, actually, because don't forget that that was the time of the big slump, poverty in Europe. And it was traditional for at least one daughter of a peasant family, sometimes more, to go off and be nuns because at least they were fed. They then found themselves in Africa, these poor girls, aged 18 or 19 or something, stuck in a convent, doing the dirty work of the convent, with no hope of getting home in those days, desperately homesick and very lonely, and not necessarily there because of a vocation. They were there because they were helping their families out. Now I see them as very tragic figures. But they were ignorant women, very brutal because of their peasant background, and they knew nothing about children, shouldn't have been anywhere near children.
When you say they were brutal, did they beat you?
Yeah, they went in for beating. They also went in for some rather nasty verbal punishment of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church at its on its lowest levels is full of devils, hellfire, worms eating corpses, and we had our bellies full of this. Dished out, I'm sure that these girls thought that this was religion. I don't think it did any of us any good. I've swapped notes now with quite a few people who were at similar convents. And I hope it's not going on anywhere still.
Well, why did you first leave your country?
Well, I can't imagine a more tedious provincial suburban society than southern Rhodesia. They talked day and night about what was then called a Calabar. And people who had slightly different ideas. You know, ideas that aren't taken for granted anywhere else in the world, regarded as wild subversives. You just had to leave or you'd go crazy.
But when you left, you really missed the physical beauty of the country.
Oh, I'd miss that. Always. But you know, and I'm now missing something that hardly exists any longer. That is the point. It's been destroyed.
Right. It's been destroyed by development and now being even further destroyed by the drought.
Well, it's the drought is doing a very good job in destroying what's left. But, you know, a couple of good rainy seasons will put things back again. So all is not lost. I hope, you know, that as we talk, I'm wondering, what I wanted to do when I wrote this book was to try and create a kind of an impressionistic picture of Zimbabwe and people who perhaps know nothing whatsoever about it, would then have some idea of what it was like and what it developed from, because that's what I used my family for, what the old days were like and the kind of society it was. It was a basis for this one. But I wonder if I succeeded, because it's so contradictory a place, you know. I could practically any statement I made about it, I could make the opposite statement, which would be equally true. That's the trouble.
What? Where do you see yourself at now in your writing? You went through a series of years when you were writing a lot of science fiction. Your new book is nonfiction and very personal. You have a recent collection of short stories that just came out. So you're kind of, in the past few years, you've been writing in several different forms.
Yes.
So where do you see yourself heading now?
Well, I'm going to write volume one of my autobiography. And then I think I might, there's another novel that I have almost finished but hasn't gelled. Then I think I'll write volume six of the Cannabis and Argus series. That's the science fiction or space fiction. And then I'll see what happens, because I'm now 73, you know, and who knows what might happen next.
So you've decided it's time to write your autobiography?
Yeah.
And what
well,
made
part
you,
of it.
Part of it, part one.
Part one.
What made you think it was time?
Oh, because if you don't, the biographers make up your life for you. You have to write it in self-defense. I'm not joking. It's true.
Doris Lessing's new memoir is called African Laughter. Her collection of short stories is called The Real Thing.
Thank you.
That's Abdullah Ibrahim improvising on Ellington. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hey, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll check in with the Bush campaign and the Clinton campaign out in the western states. Charges and countercharges going back and forth this week. A lot of talk about waffling. I'll talk with Tom Gelton about a plan proposed in Bosnia for dividing that state into autonomous regions. That plan probably will not be approved by the Serbian side. Also, we'll discuss the upcoming referendum in Canada. The vote is Monday, and the basic issue is, should Quebec have special status? The polls say the vote will go against that referendum. And then the question becomes, will Quebec opt for independence? Will Canada indeed become a loose federation of 10 states?
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that, by the usual standards, the late tenor saxophonist Ike Quebec could not be considered one of the greats. But Kevin's been listening to a new reissue, taken from the soulful sessions Quebec recorded for the Blue Note label in the years just before his death in 1963. Kevin says you only have to listen to Quebec to hear how great he is.
The latest trend in jazz reissues is away from umpteen CD megaboxes and toward more modest and affordable anthologies. That's fine, as long as the people who put them together know what they're doing. That's not always the case, but two new single CD compilations from Blue Note, both devoted to underappreciated artists, are on the right track. One is The Art of Herbie Nichols, trio recordings from the 1950s by the great composer and pianist who's still more heard about than heard. The other is called The Art of Ike Quebec. Quebec is normally regarded as a dependable second-tier jazz musician. He wasn't an amazing virtuoso or conceptualist. In fact, he liked few things better than sticking close to a good written melody. But when I listen to him, I get the kind of spiritual nourishment only the great jazz musicians impart. You feel ennobled just putting his records on. Tenor saxophone has been the medium for more soulful jazz than any other instrument. Ike Quebec got a beautiful sound from the horn, but he also understood how to use a microphone better than any saxophonist I can think of. Quebec worked for Blue Note Records as an executive as well as recording artist, and he'd obviously thought a lot and learned a lot about what recorded music should sound like. He had a genius for putting himself in simple but dramatic settings. At the end of a quartet session in 1961, he asked bass player Milt Hinton to duet with him on Nature Boy, the jazz standard which started out as a Yiddish theater song. Hinton wanted no part of it, but Quebec pestered him until he relented. As the bassist said later, the result was amazing. Mm-hmm. Nature Boy aside, Ike Quebec's natural element was the organ combo. There are organ players on half the sessions he recorded for Blue Note between 1959 and 62. These groups have always been an effective backdrop for a tenor saxophone, and they've always had a lowbrow reputation. Because they're associated with black neighborhood bars, they're too low class for the art music image that attracts culture dollars to jazz. That helps account for Ike Quebec's modest reputation. Still, no operatic tenor ever commanded a spotlight with more authority. As a ballad player, Ike Quebec had few equals and no betters.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator living in New York. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Our intern is Kezia Perlman. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Anna Quinlan discusses the presidential campaign. In her syndicated New York Times column, she's reflected on the privacy of 13-year-old Corrine Quayle, the double standard applied to the wives of Republican and Democratic presidential candidates, and the expectations and letdowns that could accompany a new president. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.